Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, how Muslims in Sudan are trying to celebrate Ramadan while the war continues all around them.
You know, Ramadan revolves around people coming together, cooking together, eating, celebrating and breaking fast together. So this year, all the families have lost members, whether to leaving the area or to death or being attacked, arrested, disappeared. The war has completely taken the soul and spirit of Ramadan.
A debrief from our colleague Ola Guerin after a trip back to the Democratic Republic of Congo more than 25 years after her last tour of duty. Also, books by African writers are in short supply on the continent, so some authors have taken matters into their own hands.
As a writer, I don't have just one publisher. So I've got a publisher in East Africa, Jahazi Press, and I have a publisher in West Africa.
So you've essentially also localized the publication so that it doesn't come from a big publishing house abroad and pushes up the cost.
Yes.
It's Friday, the 7th of March. First, we go to Sudan. It's a message we heard last year.
UN Secretary General has again called for a Ramadan ceasefire in Sudan. It's suffering the biggest displacement crisis in the world.
And then again, just a few days ago.
I send my warmest wishes as Muslims around the world begin observing the holy months of Ramadan. Ramadan embodies the values of compassion, empathy and generosity. It is an opportunity to reconnect with family and community, a chance to remember those less fortunate, and to all those who will spend this sacred time amid displacement and violence, I wish to express a special message of support. I stand with all those who are suffering. From Gaza and the wider region, to Sudan, the Sahel and beyond. And I join those observing Ramadan to call for peace and mutual respect.
The African Union's Peace and Security Council also called for a ceasefire during the holy month of Ramadan, along with the European Union, saying a ceasefire will allow the people of Sudan to be with their families and loved ones during the fast. But this war seems to be going the way it started during Ramadan 2 years ago. In that time, hundreds of thousands of people have fled to neighboring countries. Others are being bombed and starved in camps for internally displaced people. Others are trying to live as best they can in areas besieged by fighting men all around them. Women have been raped as a weapon of war. There is no end in sight because diplomatic efforts seem to bear no fruit as the killings, the rapes, the displacements continue. Imagine what life must be like under those circumstances. Imagine what fasting would be like. Let's hear from someone who is living through that right now. Duaa Tariq is from the Khartoum State Emergency Response Room. Her job is to coordinate the communal kitchens in an area held by one of the warring groups, the Rapid Support Forces. Duaa helps to feed thousands of people.
Right now, there is some heavy fights from the three entrances of Khartoum City. The military is trying to advance from the north side, the west side also, and the east side of Khartoum. So we're in the middle. We're in the last area that occupied by the RSF.
Tell us very quickly, what's life like for you in Sudan as you begin Ramadan?
This is basically the third Ramadan in war. It's very difficult. Unfortunately, we got used to fasting in very difficult circumstances. There is no availability of any life substance or materials, including food, water, electricity, internet. So the people haven't heard from their family. There is no celebrations of Ramadan. There is no enough food. Most of the people or all of the people in the area right now relies completely on the communal kitchens, which provides only one meal. You know, Ramadan revolves around people coming together, cooking together, eating, and a lot of family invitations and friends celebrating and breaking fast together. So this year comes in extreme poverty. All the families have lost members, whether to leaving the area or to death or being attacked, arrested, disappeared. So it's very devastating to witness Ramadan like this. The war has completely taken the soul and spirit of Ramadan and broke all the families in Sudan, including the ones who were able to flee the country or survive the war. So within the emergency response rooms in Khartoum in general, we provide for thousands of families. In my community here, we provide food for almost 12 or 13,000 families who are still in the area. We have more than 10 communal kitchens that serve these families because the area is very big. It has a lot of people still living here.
So every year since the war has broken out, things have got worse for people, and it's especially worse during Ramadan when people really need to be able to sustain themselves through the long, hot days of the fast. How are people managing to do that? Do you find that people are more determined to keep fasting, or can some of them, their health can't sustain it?
Some of them are still determined, but most of them can't fast because people fell to a lot of illness and sickness. Let's put it clear, people are not surviving. People are dying. The food is not enough. It's not good quality. It's not sufficient. People are still fasting, but we expect a lot of people to pass away within the next couple of weeks if the war doesn't stop in the very coming soon.
And that's people from all walks of life, different ages, different strengths, just there isn't enough. And it's not just older people or people who are very young or people who are very sick. You're talking about people in general.
I'm talking about everyone here is the same right now. So all of the people here, whether they're lost more than half of their weight or they're lost most of their weight. So everybody's sick. Everybody is not so immune. The stress also plays a big role in the people's health. The stress from the ongoing battles, strikes, the bombarding. Like today, four areas around our house were bombarded today by the fighter jets or the drones. So people live under a very intense mental and emotional circumstances. So just to add to the physical health, there is also the mental and emotional health of people. So people are under a lot of pressure.
Dua Tariq from the Khartoum State Emergency Response Room's communal kitchens. But let me leave you with the sound of happier times in Sudan during Ramadan. اشتقنا يا رمضان اشتقنا باقي كم يوم على موعدنا اشتقنا يا رمضان اشتقنا باقي كم يوم على موعدنا. Let's go next to a conflict we've covered so many times here on Focus on Africa. It's in the Democratic Republic of Congo. One of the people who's reported on that war is the BBC's international correspondent, Ola Gurin, who's just returned from the DRC, which has been at war on and off for more than three decades. The giant country, wealthy beyond belief, has never really been at peace. But war broke out into the open in the 1990s, following the genocide in neighboring Rwanda, which destabilized its twin Burundi as well. Ola went to the region around 2008-2009 as the violence swelled. The latest cycle of the war surged in January this year when a rebel group in the DRC, aided by Rwanda, began swallowing large swathes of territory in the mineral-rich east. The Congolese authorities say at least 8,500 people have been killed since the start of this year. Here's my conversation with Ola.
This wasn't my first visit to the DRC, but it's been a very long time since I was there. And my previous visit was back in 2008 and 2009. And tragically, when we came back this time, people were suffering and indeed dying because of a lot of the same issues. People had been displaced once again by a rebel movement. This time it was the M23. During my previous reporting trip, it was the Mai Mai. But the result for civilians was the same: mass displacement, suffering. And many had been killed during the takeover of Goma by the M23. The figure, according to the United Nations, is that almost 3,000 people died in the battle for the city. And we saw people who were trying desperately to survive in camps for the displaced around the city, really living in the most difficult of conditions. They weren't even living in proper tents. I mean, the tents were actually scraps of tarpaulin perched on top of this black volcanic rock that you see everywhere in Goma. And bad as the conditions were there, things became even worse when the rebels took over, because then they gave people an ultimatum to leave the city. They said, you have 72 hours and you have to go. So we actually saw families rolling up bedding and setting off once again with their belongings on their back, telling us they had nothing to go back to and didn't know how they would survive.
You've covered so many conflicts internationally. Are there similarities in conflicts, or are they all different?
I think there are often different dynamics at play, but the constant factor and the consistent theme, certainly for me, is the suffering of civilians and particularly the suffering of women and children. And that's what you could see in very stark ways in Goma. We saw hospital wards full of children who had been severely wounded by weapons of war. In one particular hospital we visited, which was supported by the Red Cross, they were running four war theatres, four surgeries specifically dealing with war wounded. Four of them were operating simultaneously through the day and through the night. And we saw a lot of young wounded children. We saw one boy whose leg had been amputated. His older sister was now his only guardian. She told us they had been the victims of a bomb dropped by the M23, which had killed their parents and other members of the family. So many lives had been torn apart in ways that were going to follow these people for decades.
One of the more devastating aspects of this war is the women and the mass rapes of women.
I was raped by two men, violently, and passed out. While the second man was raping me, I came to. He told me he would kill me if I tried to escape. I was forced to let it happen, instead of losing my life. The unlucky ones were raped. The lucky ones got out without being raped.
When I sleep at night, I see scenes of everything I've seen here coming back to me. I see the dead again, as many dead bodies as I saw here until I got out. Maybe through you, someone can help us find justice, because we've suffered a bad savagery.
That was Nadine, and before her was Pascaline. And Nadine there ending on a heart-rending note, maybe through you, you can help. What goes through you as you think about that? What do you think of when you think of you were here before and it was ever thus?
Well, one of the most important things to say is that the level of sexual violence against women in the DRC is absolutely shocking. It is an endemic problem. It has been part of three decades of conflict there. Specifically in this particular case, the two women that you heard there, Pascaline and Nadine, they were both raped in both cases by two men as they were prisoners inside the main jail in Goma. Now, during the rebel takeover of the city, which obviously was a chaotic time, many of the prison guards deserted the prison. Some of the male inmates set the prison on fire, and women and children remained trapped inside while about 4,000 male inmates managed to flee. And during that period, some of the male inmates came from a building next door into the women's prison and viciously attacked the women while they were trapped inside. And later on that night, more than 100 women burned to death and about 25 children. And we managed to speak to four survivors of that night. And the really shocking thing was that in each case, it took us some time to find them, but in the end, it wasn't that difficult. We managed to find them, but the authorities hadn't even been looking, because in each case, no official had come to speak to any of these women to ask their testimony, to take a record of what happened. Nobody had come either from the M23 rebels, who are now the only authority in Goma. And there had been no attempt to contact them by the government in Kinshasa, which had been responsible for the prison and indeed the entire city before the rebels took over. So they felt completely alone, completely abandoned, as if their lives simply did not matter.
I was reaching into your response, Ola, about being asked if there's anything that you can do. And also just, you know, women talking to you about sexual assault on this level.
I mean, we are very, it's a difficult thing to put into words, because it's a very, very hard thing for survivors to speak about. But we are very grateful when they are willing to do that, because this puts what has happened in the public domain. That is why they were speaking to us. They were hoping that in some way, by some means, that this might be an opportunity for them to get some kind of justice. Although, to be honest, they said they did not really believe it would come with the knowledge that they have of the justice system in the DRC, such as it was even before the rebels took over in Goma. But it is certainly something that is very, very painful for women to speak about. And of course, we appreciate that for the audience, it's very painful to hear. But I think it is our responsibility to tell these stories and to try to tell them in a way that is as respectful as we can be when we are dealing with women who have gone through these horrific experiences.
You spoke to a member of the M23. The Congolese government had declared them a terrorist organization and that nobody should actually interview them. They shouldn't be given a platform. This must have been quite tricky for you to negotiate. Just talk us through, you know, the thinking that went into that on the part of the BBC.
Well, in every conflict, you have to speak to all sides and you have to speak to the people who are responsible for what is going on. And if and when you do speak to them, you have to challenge them about that. And that is exactly what we did. We had an interview with Corneille Nanga, who is the head of the Congo River Alliance. Now, that's an alliance that was formed last year, which includes the M23. And he has very much emerged as the public face, if you like, of the rebel group. It took us a while to secure an interview with him, but we got one. And we asked him, you know, all of the tough questions that you would expect. We grilled him on the level of support from Rwanda, which he tried to deny, despite the fact that there is extensive documentation by UN experts going back over many years. But he claimed he, quote unquote, had not seen military assistance from Rwanda or any troops. We tackled him on the question of how many people were killed in the battle for Goma, that figure of almost 3,000, which came from the United Nations. Again, he disputed that. He said that was a lie.
I've not seen the 3,000 people. You know, Goma is a small city. I know that they were fighting in the city. But it's amazing to see that in a city like Goma, 3,000 people was killed. I don't know. But I don't see the family who are mourning.
But families have been in the morgue. Families have been collecting bodies.
And when you see the population, how they welcomed us, it's just amazing.
Just to be clear, are you saying that 3,000 people were not killed here?
No, I don't. This is a lie.
We pointed out that, in fact, families had been seen at the morgues and families had been seen carrying out burials. I also questioned him extensively on the human rights abuses carried out by the M23 over many years that have been documented, again, extensively by human rights groups. And those abuses include systematic shelling of civilian areas, a mass rape of civilians and summary executions. And he tried to dismiss all that by saying he hadn't seen the reports and hadn't read them and therefore couldn't comment. And I said, well, why have you not read them? Because these allegations have been around for years. And he then said, well, these organisations aren't the right people to be giving a judgment on human rights and we are writing our own reports. So the purpose of our interview was certainly not to give a platform to the M23. It was to try to hold them accountable for what they have done, not just in Goma, but for what they have been doing in recent years.
What was he like?
He was talkative. He is extremely articulate. He is polished. He is somebody that speaks fluently in English. His background is that he was a technocrat, a bureaucrat, if you like. He was head of the election commission in the DRC. And controversially, back in 2018, he certified the election victory of the president, Felix Tshisekedi, in a disputed election. But now, of course, he is on the other side. We asked him if he wanted to be the next president of the DRC himself. He denied that and said that the aim of the M23 and the alliance was to challenge corruption, to clean up corruption, and he said to tackle what he called a failed state.
Let's talk about the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo. They've been involved in this fight for a long time. Did you speak to them?
We looked for a response from the government. We weren't able to get one. We went through a series of steps to try to get a government comment. We contacted the information minister and his team. He was out of the country. His team suggested we spoke to the Justice Ministry but couldn't give us any contact information. We got contact information for the Justice Minister and his office, sent them queries by email, by text and by WhatsApp and received no response. So we were keen to hear from the government, but we were unable to get any response from the authorities in Kinshasa. I think it is important to say that it is not only the M23 who are accused of widespread human rights abuses. The same allegations are made by human rights organisations against the Congolese army, the FARDC, and also against many of the armed groups that are operating in the DRC and have operated over many years. And there are about 100 armed groups in the DRC. But the situation today is that the M23 is certainly the most powerful of those groups and is continuing to advance in the east of the country. Now, Corneille Nangaa told us they would go as far as the capital, Kinshasa, if, as he claimed, they continued to come under attack from the government.
You're back on base now. The conflict continues, but your coverage of it for now is over. Do you leave it behind you? What happens when you've gone? What do you do to perhaps divest yourself of what you've seen, what you've heard, what you've been told? Because you have to.
I don't think you ever really leave stories behind you. Obviously, you have to compartmentalize to a certain extent because often when we leave one story, we're going to the next. And for example, this year, just before we went to the DRC, we spent a very intense 3 weeks in Ukraine. And that's often the nature of the work, that we are moving from one story to another. But, you know, you can't simply switch off and you can't forget the people you have met and what they have been through. And you don't want to forget that because their stories and their needs and their suffering deserve to be remembered. And some said they were hoping that there would be more robust action by the international community, in particular, that there would be further sanctions applied against Rwanda, who they hold responsible, as do the UN and the US, for what the M23 is doing. So people were hoping that in some ways, you know, we could give them a voice. That's all we can do. It is both the least and the most that we are able to do in these circumstances. But that is certainly something we try to do.
The BBC's Orla Gurin. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Let's talk about books. And if you know me, you'll know that I like nothing better than to talk about books, stories, writing. Actually, I do like something better than that. I love reading. I live in London, though, so I have a world of books and events by authors to attend. But that's not the case for so many lovers of books and reading across the continent. Books are expensive. Books by African authors tend to be scarce, and events by writers, not plentiful. Libraries, the places that made me and so many others avid, lifelong readers, are vanishing. But African literature is thriving globally, with renowned authors like Tsitsi Dangarembga, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, and Maza Mengistu, and others receiving international acclaim. This year, the release of Chimamanda's first novel in 10 years was a hotly anticipated publishing event. I went to a talk she gave, and the auditorium was packed. Hundreds of books were sold, and that was just one event here in London. But Chimamanda and other writers and readers have decided to right this wrong, did you see what I did there, by taking matters into their own hands. We'll be hearing from the award-winning writer and publisher Zukiswa Wana and Dagnachio Tesfaye, who's the owner of Tuba, the online platform for Ethiopian books. But first, here's Chimamanda's solution.
I have Nigerian editions of my books. I have a wonderful Nigerian publisher. And so my books, the Nigerian edition is, you know, relatively affordable in Nigeria and available. So we're not importing books. And actually across the continent, there are independent publishers who are doing this. If you import books, it just means that automatically books will not be available to a large percentage of the population. And when I started writing, it was very important to me to be read in Nigeria, in Africa. Mm. And so having my books published by my Nigerian publisher and also by other smaller independent publishers across the continent, Zimbabwe, we're changing it. You know, it is changing, and it will continue to change, because there is one of the wonderful things that's happened in the literary world among the continent is a kind of sort of the surge of doing. We know that there are problems, and sometimes they're quite huge, but people are doing things, and a publisher like mine in Nigeria is an example of that.
Now to my conversation about the wider challenges and solutions. So, Zuki Swawana, we're going to start with you. A quick introduction and tell us where you're based.
I'm a writer, an editor, a publisher, a curator, and I can be found anywhere on the continent any given Sunday.
Or Tuesday or Thursday. Danya exactly. Chu, what about you? You're in Addis Ababa at the moment, right?
Yes, I am the co-founder of Tuba. I'm a software engineer by profession, but primarily work on Tuba. Yeah. That's pretty much it.
All right, then. So tell us about Tuba then, because that is the thing that at the moment you feel defines you the most.
Oh, so Tuba is an ebook and audiobook platform for Ethiopian books. It's sort of a Kindle Myth Audible type of platform.
And did you start it because you were responding to a need?
Yeah. So me and my co-founder, we started it because we saw the need from ourselves in the beginning, because we used to read foreign books on our phones, but we weren't reading much of the local content. And we started to look deeper into it. Why are we not reading? Why? What is the problem? And long story short, we saw that accessibility and affordability were a hurdle. For that, and that's how we started Tuba.
Zukiswa, you've been active for a very long time in the various roles as a writer, as a publisher, you know, all kinds of different ways in which you've addressed the issue, I think, of the availability and affordability of African books by African writers. Why are they so expensive and why are they so unavailable?
As far as the expense is concerned, I truly believe that a lot of it has to do with the taxation of books on this continent. It's much cheaper to go for a movie than it is to go and buy a book. And I think there is level of investment in people not reading and therefore not questioning. But the fact that we see in streets in Lagos and streets in Nairobi, in streets in Joburg, all over the continent, in Kinshasa, that we see secondhand books on sale means perhaps they is an interest in people reading, but it depends then on what it is that's available. And a lot of times it's books that are dumped by publishers from the West. They dump them as a donation to Africa or whatever. And if you find novels, if you find, I'm sure, you know, tragic though it is, I'm sure the streets of Lagos already have illegal copies of Chimamanda's book that came out this week.
Before we go there, I just want us to kind of focus on why African authors are so unavailable. Does it have to do with the perception that there is no interest, or is it that there is no interest because there's no real promotion of those books, for instance, or, you know, people feeling that there's no real value in it in a general sense, not very specifically people who act intentionally to buy those books?
I don't know that they're not really available, Audrey, to be honest. Suddenly, I see a change. There's something called Book Farm Africa, and it's writers and distributors and bookshop owners from across the continent. And they somehow seem to have found ways of getting books to each other. Sometimes in one country, one publisher to another publisher will send a PDF and that one will print it. So I think it's certainly a story that's beginning to change. I've certainly seen it since 2021.
Danya Chu, let's talk about weak currencies and taxes and how they affect the prices of books on the continent. For an example, let's just look at The Shadow King, which is by Maza Mengistu. She wrote a book that was shortlisted for the Booker Prize in 2020. In the UK, it cost £9. I bought mine for even less than that because I went to an event where she spoke. But in one of the bookshops in Addis, it cost 3,000 birr, which is about £19 and $24. And that is like almost a fifth of the salary of a university lecturer a month in Ethiopia.
Yes, that's true. It's quite difficult here because there's different taxes that are levied on books, which even without the taxes, it's already expensive here, as you mentioned. I also think it has to do on top of the taxes, such expensive books are not affordable to the wider public, so their audience is limited. I would say the sellers increase the markup as well to make up for that difference. But the other challenges I would say is there aren't publishers in the traditional sense in Ethiopia, so it's more just either people who, like companies who print books or sell books.
I think he's actually right. I was in Addis 2 weeks ago and I took some books and, you know, I was lucky that I went to Fendeka and, you know, a few people bought everything that I had, but it was the type of crowd that had the money to buy those books.
You touched on something earlier. It almost sounded like you were saying that there are structural and political reasons why people are discouraged from reading.
Yes, I did touch on it. And I think this is all over the continent, that a reading public is a questioning public. And living in the world that we do today, the powers that be do not find it favorable for everybody to be, for people to be reading so that they can question what is happening and maybe injustices and unfairness and poverty versus wealth. As I was mentioning, I was in Addis, for instance, and there is the gentrification of Addis, but people have been taken out. And we're seeing this all over the continent, not just Addis. We're seeing it everywhere where poor people are being pushed out of the city. As an art form, music is more popular, but also considered more dangerous because once a song comes and people take it up, politicians tend to find that more dangerous. But so long as they can suppress books and people are not reading and there isn't an investment to get people reading, then there is no danger that new ideas will come to people and they will question.
Daniel Chut, you responded to these challenges by hosting it or starting a digital platform. So tell us a little bit more about it.
Our platform is called Tuba. And as I mentioned earlier, the conception was based on our specific needs. You know, there was a lot of difficulty with accessibility and affordability. Accessibility meaning the books are there, but there are only a few bookstores would have them. Sometimes they would run out. So it's quite difficult to get a hold of the book. And affordability-wise, once you get the book, it's hard to afford it.
So do people pay Tuba? Do they pay a subscription in order to access books?
They pay for a book they want to buy for a fraction of the cost of the hard copy price on the market. I would say about one third or one fourth of the price in the market. They would pay for an ebook on Tuba. They pay for a specific book and they own that book for as long as they want. They can read it anytime they want. Similarly, in the case of audiobooks, what we've noticed is Ethiopia has a rich oral history and people are very familiar with listening to stories, as well as people have hectic days, especially with low incomes. A lot of people have two jobs and things like that. So they're moving a lot. They're doing this and that at the same time. So with audiobooks, they get to read the books, you know, while multitasking, and the audiobooks are just as affordable. So we've been able to onboard a lot of the popular authors in the country into our platform and have their books available to the public. We've also seen a lot of people reading pirated books online and things like that. That's primarily the reason we're only targeting Ethiopian books.
So Giswa, I was going to pick up on the piracy because you raised it earlier as well. Generally, people who produce and create things don't like their work being pirated. What's your view on it?
I feel very strongly about it. I think people should pay for art because art, in a way, it entertains, but it also educates. But when we read a book, when we listen to music, the person who's making the music must still pay the studio. The person who's writing the book must still pay electricity and they must still eat. So I think we must really take a look at all creation of art as work.
Yeah. Firstly, books are such beautiful artifacts. And now you're talking about reading it as a kind of, you know, just a clutch of papers. But speaking of Chimamanda, she spoke about having a Nigerian publisher, which makes her books cheap to buy in Nigeria. She also has a publisher, I think, in Zimbabwe. So she's, as an artist or as a writer, she's decided that she wants her books to be cheaper on the continent. Let's talk about other options that you yourself have been and other initiatives that you have been involved in, Zukiswa, to make books cheaper on the continent and more available.
As a publisher, what I generally do is I send a book to another publisher in another country if I want it in the region. The other thing, just like as a writer, I don't have just one publisher. So I've got a publisher in East Africa, Jahazi Press, and I have a publisher in West Africa, and I have a publisher here in Southern Africa. But I also think that it kind of reduces the chance of books being pirated. They have different covers in each of the region.
So you've essentially also localized the publication so that it doesn't come from a big publishing house abroad and pushes up
yes.
the cost.
Yes.
Quickly, last words about encouraging people to read African writers. What would you say?
Well, I think a major reason why you'd want to do it is because we've got so many beautiful, wonderful stories. We've got sci-fi, we've got romance, we've got crime, we've got all the genres you can think of. And it's also the beauty of seeing yourself in a book, even though it might be fiction. Before you watch a movie, it has to be written. So think of a book that way, except you create the characters in your head. The movie is never as good as the book itself because your imagination is limitless.
Tanya Chu Tesfaye, what about you? What would you say to people to encourage them to take up a book by an African writer?
I share Zubi's comments as well, especially regarding African authors. We also have a lot of untold stories, be it indigenous stories or be it any urban stories, things like that. Africans need to pick those books up and read as much as they can.
That was a fascinating conversation with the award-winning writer, publisher and curator Zukiswa Wana and the owner of the online platform for Ethiopian books, Tanya Chu Tesfaye. Focus on Africa was diligently created by Bella Hassan and Yvette Twagiramaria here in London. Carney Sharp was in charge of quality and quantity. Philip Bull was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.